Imagine a world where firefighters don't extinguish flames, they create them. Guy Montag wears his beetle black helmet emblazoned with the number 451 with pride as he burns books, reveling in the spectacle of pages turning to ash beneath his kerosene hose. "It was a pleasure to burn," he declares in the opening line, breathing in the kerosene that clings to him like cologne. This is the disturbing reality of Ray Bradbury's prophetic masterpiece, where literature has been systematically eliminated and owning books is a crime punishable by having your home incinerated. Why such extreme measures? The state maintains that books cause unhappiness by presenting conflicting ideas and uncomfortable truths. Instead, citizens immerse themselves in wall-sized interactive television programs featuring mindless entertainment, listen to seashell radio, thimbles plugged into their ears, and drive at reckless speeds. A perfect system of distraction, ensuring no one thinks too deeply about their lives. When was the last time you chose a challenging book over scrolling through easily digestible content? Walking home one evening, Montag meets his new neighbor, 17-year-old Clarice McClellan, whose simple question leaves him speechless. "Are you happy?" Unlike others, Clarice notices what most ignore: morning dew, the man in the moon, the scent of old leaves. She rubs dandelions under her chin, tastes rain, and watches sunsets with childlike wonder. Their conversations awaken something dormant in Montag as she describes her family, who discuss art, philosophy, and history together, a radical act in their world of constant sensory bombardment. At school, Clarice stands out painfully. Students are sedated with entertainment rather than educated, and asking why instead of how marks her as dangerous. "I'm afraid of children my own age," she confesses. "They kill each other." Then, abruptly, Clarice disappears, hit by a speeding car and erased from existence. Her death becomes Montag's turning point, forcing him to confront the emptiness beneath society's pleasant surface. How often do we silence our own curiosity for comfortable conformity? The mechanical hound haunts the firehouse. An eight-legged robotic bloodhound with a needle-sharp proboscis programmed to track anyone by their chemical composition. This merciless machine represents technology divorced from humanity, used for control rather than liberation. When Montag expresses concern that the hound doesn't like him, his colleagues laugh, yet he senses something malevolent in the way it growls when he passes, watching him with faintly glowing green-blue neon light eyes. Technology permeates every aspect of society. Citizens wear seashell radio earpieces, pumping constant entertainment directly into their ears. Montag's wife Mildred spends her days interacting with her parlor family, characters on three wall-sized television screens, even begging for a fourth wall to complete the immersive experience. What makes Bradbury's vision particularly unsettling is how familiar it feels decades later. Our own society increasingly resembles his dystopia. Earbuds isolate us. Algorithms feed us personalized content, reinforcing existing beliefs. Attention spans shrink as information accelerates. The question isn't whether technology itself is good or bad, but rather what values are encoded in our machines and who controls them. Beneath this technologically advanced society lies profound emptiness. Montag recognizes this void in his marriage as he observes Mildred's addiction to sleeping pills and television, her inability to recall their meeting, and her disinterest in meaningful conversation. When Mildred hosts friends for a television viewing party, their conversation reveals lives without authentic connection. One woman mentions her husband's war deployment without emotion. Another discusses sending her children to school and daycare to avoid them. Both have cycled through multiple marriages, treating relationships as disposable entertainment. Their political engagement is equally shallow. They voted for the presidential candidate with better looks and a nicer name. The scene culminates when Montag, unable to tolerate their emptiness, reads poetry aloud. One woman cries uncontrollably while another reacts with anger, calling poetry nasty for making her uncomfortable. Their responses reveal how thoroughly they've been conditioned to reject anything provoking genuine emotion or thought. How many of us know more about fictional characters than our own neighbors? Books in this society aren't merely banned. They're portrayed as actively dangerous weapons that create unhappiness by introducing conflicting ideas and uncomfortable truths. Montag has been secretly collecting books in his home's ventilation system. When he reveals this contraband to Mildred, she reacts with horror, seeing them as a threat to their safety. Captain Beatty explains how books became prohibited. Minority groups objected to offensive portrayals, which expanded to removing anything making anyone uncomfortable. You must understand that our civilization is so vast that we can't have our minorities upset and stirred. Ask yourself, what do we want in this country above all? People want to be happy. Colored people don't like Little Black Sambo. Burn it. White people don't feel good about Uncle Tom's Cabin. Burn it. This reveals censorship's insidious nature, beginning with seemingly reasonable objections, but expanding until all challenging material disappears. Bradbury suggests people often participate in their own intellectual imprisonment by choosing comfort over freedom. Desperate for guidance, Montag seeks out Professor Faber, a retired English professor. Faber explains that books' value lies not in the objects themselves, but in three abandoned elements: quality information with texture and pores where readers find themselves, leisure time to digest ideas rather than rushing between sensations, and the right to act on what one learns. Books were only one type of receptacle where we stored things we were afraid we might forget, Faber explains. The magic is only in what books say, how they stitch the patches of the universe together into one garment for us. After killing Captain Beatty and escaping, Montag finds intellectual exiles who preserve literature by memorizing entire books, becoming living books that can't be burned. We are all bits and pieces of history and literature and international law, explains their leader Granger. Each person memorizes a text and passes it to someone younger, ensuring knowledge survives even without physical books. A human library preserving civilization's intellectual heritage until society wants books again. As jets appear overhead, the city is obliterated by bombs. The foreshadowed war arrives, destroying the civilization that burned its own wisdom. Bradbury introduces the novel's central symbol, the phoenix. Granger compares humanity to this mythical bird that burns itself to ashes only to be reborn. But we know the damn silly thing we just did, he says, of civilization's cyclical self-destruction. As dawn breaks after the bombing, the group begins walking toward the ruined city, each silently reciting their memorized books. Montag thinks of what he will offer, a passage from Revelation about the tree whose leaves were for the healing of the nations. The conclusion suggests civilization's rebirth depends not on technology, but on remembered wisdom. The group carries no weapons, only knowledge preserved in their minds. Their mission isn't conquest, but reconstruction, based on understanding rather than forgetting. In our age of information overload and shortened attention spans, this message resonates. True resistance begins with remembering what matters, preserving wisdom, and walking toward a better world where books illuminate rather than burn.